charge we're not sure about.
So, as a technology podcast, it would not be right for us to miss wishing Linux a very happy 25th birthday. Can we get a round of applause for Linux on 25, yeah? But, right, 25's pretty impressive, right? But I know a number that's way more impressive than 25. How's about 100? So this is episode 100 of the In Tech We Trust podcast.
Now we're talking.
Hey, so we've got 25th birthday for Linux. We've got episode numero uno 100 for us here. And we've got some other news as well. So, Yadin, you've given us like a slight inside track on this. You've got a new job or a new role, right? But you haven't even told us what it is yet. So go on.
Yeah, and actually, so I'll be breaking the news here first before it even gets posted on LinkedIn. So if you're hearing this, you're hearing it first, unless, of course, you know, Nigel, it takes you a long time to edit the podcast.
Oh, mate, I know.
That I'm now a newly minted marketer. After being a part of services and technology teams for many, many years, helping with all the technical sides of everything, I'm going over to the other side. Some would say the dark side. Some would say other things. But I'm super, super excited about being part of the marketing team here at Druvenow. And it was a big, big change in bringing a lot of the customer and technical acumen and all that, you know, customer-focused stuff over to the marketing team. So I'm really, really jazzed about that. So I'll be in charge of content marketing over there. So I'll be creating content like I've been before. Videos, podcasts, blogs, creating more content.
Now you can help us actually figure out how the hell to market this podcast.
Exactly. I'll be bringing all that inside marketing, you know, mojo to the show.
Let's have a quick rundown on the agenda, right? So we've got a bunch of tech stuff and a bunch of business stuff as usual. So there's container-aware load balancing from Amazon Web Services. SQL Server is now on the Google Cloud. Oh, I like this one. Bing. Apparently a few days ago, it sunk the Australian city of Melbourne off the east coast of Japan. Arm's getting into supercomputers. More business-related, we've got huge numbers on the horizon for public cloud services and augmented reality and virtual reality. And not such huge numbers, but apparently Microsoft are paying people to use the Edge browser. So we've got all of that, and we've got a bunch more stuff. So I tell you what, let's hit the Google compute engine accepting SQL Server in there right now. My gut feel was that this is probably a Diane thing, as Google are starting to focus more on enterprise customers. And I think we know that enterprise customers want to take their existing legacy technologies or heritage technologies, as some people call them, and still run them in the cloud. So Microsoft SQL Server officially available now or very soon, I think, on the Google compute engine. Rick, I know you've got some thoughts on that yourself personally?
Well, I think for one, this is a subtle, you know, edge to what Microsoft has been doing a long time with Azure, with SQL in Azure. But if you think about the application profile, I would venture any business, forget the enterprise, I would venture any business has some amount of SQL Server in play. And, you know, you might not be able to make the same comment about Oracle. But I think having SQL Server in the Google Compute Cloud is very much, you know, a good move to the applications that are out there. So I think this is a good move, ecosystem play, and it's going to have something that's going to have very broad applicability. The other twist to this that I'm not sure how to, you know, think about it in 2 years is the way the SQL Server 2016 stretch clusters are going to automatically put tiers into Azure, so that you could, you know, if only 10% of your data is important and hot, just keep that on-prem on good storage, put the other 90% in Azure of these databases. You're going to be able to do that with SQL 2016. So this might be a little bit late for a good ecosystem move, but nonetheless, I think it's a positive move.
Do you think Microsoft would lock the APIs for that so that you could only tier into Azure, or do you think they would open them up and allow you to tier into AWS and Google and things like that?
Oh, no, I can't imagine it going into Azure or anything other than Azure.
Really?
Sorry. Oh, yeah, because I think it's I don't think it's even possible unless you go with the Azure stack on premises, but I might go Google that because we've been corrected before on this podcast.
Is that right?
I'm going to go look that up as we carry on.
So just to everybody else on the podcast while you're looking that up then, does anybody have any thoughts around whether or not this is maybe an admission from Google that its own like cloud-based database services are not good enough that customers would want to refactor onto them? Or is it very much more just that they see it as an easier path for customers to get onto the Google Cloud by just taking their existing applications? Because there's this kind of whole thing, isn't there, right, that, you know, making a switch to something like a public cloud service is maybe a great opportunity to refactor your applications into something a little bit more cloud native. Whereas if you just lift and shift your old stuff, it's like, I mean, it's okay, but you're not getting like the full benefits, right? So I don't know, is this a good thing that we're doing here, or are we going to be thinking in 5 or 10 years time, hell, we've just lifted the same crap onto a new platform?
It doesn't matter as long as the customers are paying for it, right?
I mean, I get that for Google's perspective and what have you. And maybe I'm naive with this, right? But from the, you know, the customer's perspective, yes, it's easy to do that. And it's great for Google and Microsoft, I guess, to keep SQL Server. But surely customers in the long run would want to have better built systems or systems built more for the future, right?
No, they just want to save money and they don't want to invest in the technology. Look, if Google's going to play in this business, they have to have it. This is like way overdue. It's just a sign of them getting real about the cloud business, because you can run SQL Server on Amazon. You can run it on Microsoft or Azure for sure. I mean, they're just behind and catching up. That's all this is.
Yeah, it's a table stake that they've needed to have really for a long time. The only other one a little bit more primitive would be Windows Server VMs in the Google Compute Cloud, right? So, you know, instances might be a better word. But any of all that being said, quick follow-up on the fact check, Stretch Database does only go to Azure.
I think it's interesting. I think it's more to bring in legacy applications than new ones. Most of the developers I talk to anyway are more interested in using Postgres or NoSQL. So, Nigel, I'm with you. I think it's kind of a play to get current applications there. Now, whether that's how we're going to continue developing applications, I think that's going to change.
But I think, I guess we all agree that it is table stakes. They've got other database options out there, including their own cloud-based databases, right? But now they've added this. So if you're potentially going to be a Google Cloud customer, you've got both choices, right?
Yeah, I think that just reduces friction. Just to pile on your point, Lauren, was that it's going to be a lot of legacy stuff that goes up there. Because I think as most people see it when they're going into, you know, to places, and I'm sure Google sees this as well, is that status quo is the biggest competitor anywhere. People want to do the same thing with the same, you know, setup because they've got, you know, automation set up, or they've got some script running, or they've been ingrained in that, you know, that mindset. And so if they can get this old workload up to someplace that's new, and then they can start taking advantage of some of the other services around that, that becomes reduced friction to start moving other things and then start to natively develop on a platform like Google.
Okay, so sticking with kind of cloud-based things, right, and a little bit Microsofty here. I don't know who saw the story recently, I think it was in the Register, about Bing and Microsoft Maps or whatever it is. They got north and south wrong somehow, and they landed the city of Melbourne, which has like 4 million people live in it. Instead of being in southern Australia in Victoria, they landed it somewhere off the east coast of Japan in the Pacific Ocean. Now, kind of a funny story, okay, and apparently they were leveraging some information from Wikipedia that was bad. But for me, right, the whole thing was like, as autonomous cars and all this kind of stuff comes more and more real and more every day for us, things like this just can't fail and can't get it wrong, right? Because when we're relying on Google Maps and Bing Maps or whatever they are in the future, and something like this either gets hacked or it just gets it wrong, I mean, it just doesn't bear to think what might go wrong, right?
I think they were just taking a page out of Apple Maps, right?
That's a low blow.
Well, hold on. You know, this has happened before. There was a time that you go to Google Maps and say, I want to go from somewhere in Japan to Seoul, Korea. And they had like driving, walking across the street. And then there was a time it said, get on a jet ski and go across the Sea of Japan for 63 miles. Does anybody remember that?
Yeah, but that's funny.
And it's doable,
right? It's still accurate. It's just hilarious. It's not like, hey, let's put this city in Australia, like, way the hell over here.
It makes me think, though, right, that at least on the topic of autonomous cars, right, and I know we talk about this a lot at the moment, actually, but I've always tended to focus on the cars themselves and the technology in there, but they're plugging into, like, vital third-party and external services like maps and like GPS and stuff that we've talked about before. And surely there comes a point where we've got to – clearly we've got to take some of this stuff more seriously, right? This is a funny story, okay? Melbourne ends up in the ocean off the coast of Japan, right? But it gets not funny when a similar mistake costs a life or ruins a business or something like that, surely.
Yeah, imagine if like you had a whole fleet of drones running off of this at the back end. You might not be terribly happy when the drone tries to fly out into the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, I mean, so you get a flip bit. You know, it's a negative value instead of a positive value. I think the thing is that people want to trust these maps a lot more than they ought to. There are stories, of course, about people driving into remote places and dying because they're in extreme weather and they get lost, they get stuck in, you know, snowstorms and whatnot. This stuff happens. It gives pause to reflect on the accuracy of this stuff and what it's doing to us, right? And so it's an interesting thing, Nigel. I asked the question, what about autonomous cars? What happens if 7 years from now, when we're starting to use autonomous cars in a number of ways in large cities, and, you know, we're using ride-sharing services with autonomous cars, and then something goes horribly wrong with a mapping service that, you know, one of these cars or one of these companies or all the companies use, right? I mean, it's worth thinking about. Not that we're going to stop it here, not that anybody's going to stop it, but it's just worth understanding that bit flipping errors could be really interesting.
Yeah, I think there's a human element that needs to be inserted here. And I think some things that we take for granted being a part of a certain generation that didn't grow up with this stuff. And you look at it, you look at something, you use common sense before, you go to downtown Manhattan or something like that. And before you're in a cab and you've got a human driving the car and they're taking some way you know is a wrong way, or you know, like, as bad traffic, and you're going to, you know, interject with that. Just like, you know, getting any, you know, to any car, self-driving car, and going off in a, you know, XYZ location, there's got to be at least some idea that you have of the direction the car should be going so that you can then correct it if that happens. Otherwise, you're really just, you know, you are relying way too much on the technology in the back end, and human intervention is constantly needed for errors like these.
I mean, I wonder, Yadin, would you take, would you use Google Maps or Waze to go from San Diego to Tijuana?
I'm not sure if I would go to Tijuana using any service.
I've used Google Maps. I've jumped in my car and drove to Toronto straight through.
We've all done that though, Rick. I mean, that's...
But I mean... TJ, TO, doesn't matter. I think that there's a lack of validation. That's the root of this problem for these data points, whether it came from WikiWiki or what. But I think that we just have to have these mechanisms that crowdsourced, or even if I upload something from my phone, you know, there's Waze in particular will help kind of adjust roads and traffic patterns and stuff. Even that can be wrong. You know, I might be on a sidewalk with my map, but I'm contributing data what might be thought to be the road or the bike path or whatever. So there's this bigger need of validation for all these unnatural inputs.
So here we go, right? So I've been in the States for the last 4 weeks, right? And I have driven everywhere, and I mean everywhere, with Google Maps. And my oldest daughter, she's now the one that picks up my phone and says, okay, Google, take me to Glenwood Springs, Colorado, or whatever, right? And like, I kind of get that there can be mistakes and things like that, but this is my 10-year-old daughter, and she is growing up being the one telling Google, take me to Denver, take me to the PGA Superstore in Denver or whatever. She's doing it all the time, and I think she just implicitly trusts, and she's part of this generation that's growing up. This is the norm, and... I don't know. I think maybe back to your point, Yadin, I struggle with the idea that we're going to have a human element in some of these things in the future. Yes, maybe today, but really for like maps and things in 5 years, certainly 10 years, we can't be relying on a human element, right? We've got to be able to get things right better in the code, self-validation and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent we're gonna get there, and it has to get there because you want to be able to reliably say, "Hey, Google, take me to X location," and actually get there. And if there is an error, it may only last for like 20 or 30 minutes, like maximum, because there's tons of data going across. Because the scenario you're talking about, where your daughter's talking to the phone, that's really, I liken that to a line of ants going along a trail, and you drop like a stick or a drop of water in that ant trail, and all the ants absolutely go nuts, and everything blows up, and the ants have no idea where to go. And that's going to happen at a certain point because there's not going to be that human validation on a real-time basis, and people are going to rely so heavily on it that any little error will affect a whole bunch of people. It may only affect them for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, a half an hour, but for that half hour, it will affect people dramatically. And I think we're already seeing a little bit of that just because there's not that human validation that's done beforehand.
So what if we have something like where my phone or my car or whatever has a map system, okay, or a navigation system, and instead of just using Google Maps, it uses, let's say, three mapping systems, and as long as two of them always agree, then it's like, boom, we're good to go. And that would potentially, well, look, we're trying to solve problems here, and maybe we shouldn't do that.
Heck, let's start a company, Nigel. It's map reconciliation technologies.
The thing is, though, there is, and we'll maybe talk about this under the business section as well, there is so much money that's going to be made and invested into, well, obviously we know public cloud services. We're going to talk about virtual reality and augmented reality. These kind of services that become like key components to society and life. Mark, there is going to be shed loads of money in that, right?
Well, you would think so, but how much money do you think is made by the GPS satellites themselves? Yeah. Zip. Yeah. Zip. Yeah. None.
There's a reason why it's free. There's value in that data to other people.
I get that. We talked about that before, didn't we, to do with Congress and the government and things, yeah?
Oh, that's right. You put out that piece on that GPS satellite network, didn't you, Mark?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's all U.S. Air Force funded.
So let's move on then. Something a little bit slightly different. Lauren, I know you've got some opinions on this one coming up, right? We're starting to see ARM technologies in supercomputers, which is really interesting. You know, from my perspective, right, as a Brit who's, you know, I'm not involved with ARM or anything like that, but like to take a kind of a prideful look at it as it progress. I know it's owned by some Japanese supergiant company now, but anyway, ARM is getting into supercomputers. Tell us a little bit about that, Lauren.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. They're using a, well, quote-unquote new vector-based technology in their chips, which is actually from the 80s and 90s what we used to do until Intel came out with its RISC, you know, RISC chip that was just a little more affordable, basically, and that's why we moved away, at least from what I'm reading about it. So now both ARM and Intel have these vector-based architecture in their chips, in the newer chips that are coming out for the supercomputers. And supposedly, you know, they'll boost performance as well as reduce some power consumption. So, you know, power consumption, I think, is going to be, or is already, very important, especially as we are making these giant computers that do all this processing with big data and analytics and all that good stuff. So it's pretty interesting. And you know, as we know, ARM hasn't had a great push in the data center. So it'll be interesting to see if this gets them in.
Do you think this is going to be like just riding some momentum from some of the mobile wins they've had? And also, second question too to you, Lauren, do you think this is really going to help your VC money boost and stock options?
Well, I've already sold, so it's not doing much for me. I have no vested interest in ARM anymore, except as I think it's interesting to watch. I forget your first question.
So let me just interject on that first question, Yadin, about leveraging momentum from mobile devices and things like that. I don't know if it's directly correlated, right? But I know that one of the things that was cited as to why ARM was chosen for this particular supercomputer over Spark was just the sheer huge ecosystem that is growing up and springing up around ARM chips these days. Things like, you know, the software that's available for it and the tools and things like that, but also the number of developers there are that are out there that have the skills to develop against ARM technologies. And I'm pretty sure some of that, in fact, probably quite a lot of that, is as a result of how popular it's become in the mobile devices.
Yeah, I think we've seen that ecosystem makes a huge difference. So that makes sense to me.
I mean, it's like we talk about in the past, we've talked about mobile devices and things, right? And yes, the hardware is important, but it's always about the applications at the end of the day, right? You can have a great platform, hello, Windows Phone, and if there's no apps for it other than Mark's secret apps, right, then it dies a death, right? And maybe it's a slightly similar thing that I don't know whether the ARM chips themselves are actually superior to Spark, you know, enough to make such a change. But the fact that there's tools, there's people out there that can code to it, there's software out there, that is the big thing, right? I mean, cost's big and stuff as well. But, you know, that kind of stuff is the huge kind of changing factors.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, Nigel. I think it's cost. I think it's a cost opportunity. People don't spend a lot of money on HPC computer systems, right? They buy lots of them, but these are not high margin machines. Government labs, you know, people buying, you know, they buy them by the thousands and they want the price down, right? This is not a high margin business. And so if you can use ARM chips, you can potentially win business by just selling this stuff for less.
I think they're very long-term investment supercomputers as well, aren't they? And it seems like ARM has a great roadmap ahead of it at the moment. Look, I'm not an expert, but I'd say maybe not so much for Spark. I don't know. Especially when you factor in things like the tooling and, you know, the number of people that code to it and stuff like that. ARM is on the way up. It's on the rise and it's got a bright future. Spark, I'm not saying it's got a grim future, but it's certainly not on a meteoric rise like ARM.
Yeah, that sounds rational to me. I don't know that Spark has a big future either. ARM certainly does. And if you can make a supercomputer, you know, I was kind of wondering if this is going to have any influence on the HPE Moonshot systems, right? Aren't they like 45 ARM processors in a box? I mean, that's not necessarily a supercomputer, but it's, you know, a number of processors. And I haven't seen anything about this supercomputer thing tied into Moonshot in any way. Anybody else see anything about that?
No, I did not.
No, me either. But I mean, I'd still want to say that Intel's doing a similar thing with their chips too. So for ARM to knock out that incumbent, you know, it'll be interesting.
Okay, so let's flip to business news, right? Let's try and maybe hit these two first items maybe together. I don't know. But I think it was IDC, probably IDC in both accounts, were saying that public cloud spending is expected to hit $100 billion in 5 years' time. Which is a significant increase, but this is the one that caught me, right? Virtual reality and augmented reality is expected to be a $160 billion market by 2020, so within the next 4 years. And I'm like, that right there is some serious cash, okay? And if we're going to start a sideline business, you know, augmented reality or virtual reality, it looks like people are going to be lapping that up and piling the dough into it. So I thought they were both really interesting. And I'm really keen on this kind of virtual reality and augmented reality. Has anybody on the show actually used like Oculus Rift or anything like that? Because I've not.
And I think that's actually the point too. I have not, and I don't talk to anyone that does. And so I think the $162 billion, that's a bit of a fantasy number in my opinion. I don't think it's going to get adopted that rate. I think it's going to be huge. I think at some point it is going to be that big. Not nearly as fast as what they're talking about though.
You know what though? We need Gabriel on because I know he's more into gaming than some of us, right? Certainly more than I am. And one of the things that was cited as pushing this number so high is that they expect it to take off at first in the gaming industry. And the gaming industry, that's a pretty big market, right? But it's one that I don't have my finger on the pulse of.
You know what I think would be more interesting than gaming is actually just watching things. I mean, the Olympics just, you know, this year going on right now is taking in, you know, using cameras that they can have, you know, fish or feed streams to VR and AR. And literally like the diving competitions, they'll put a camera right like on the lower diving board so that if you're watching it with VR goggles, you can actually look up and see the diver and then watch him as he goes down, following him or her with your head.
Cool.
Like stuff like that makes me think, you know what, this is going to be big and I think it's going to be sooner than later.
You know what you made me think, Lauren? That if I had like Oculus Rift or something on while I was watching Katie Ledecky absolutely destroy the field so that she finished and the rest of them weren't even in the camera shot, I could have twisted my head to see how far frickin' behind they were.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly.
there's a market in that. But you know what? Maybe I'm going to get like a little bit crazy here, because I like the idea of Oculus Rift and things like that, right? But what I really want is I don't want to be walking around with some like hideous device on my head that's augmenting my reality, okay? I want it built into my biology. Like, I want it like inside of my head and wired directly into my eyes. No, just bear with me for a second here, right? Because it's definitely possible. And when I say possible here, like, it's not 100 years away where we could wire things into our eyes so that we could have infrared vision. So we could see better at night and stuff like that. Or we could augment our own hearing to hear different pitches and tones like dogs and other animals and things like that. Because I've read before, right, where, in fact, I read in a book called, Incognito. I highly recommend the book, right? It's about brain science. But it cites instances where they've taken blind people and they've attached cameras to them and given them sensory inputs, like jabbing them in different places on their back was one example. And over time, the brain learns that, right, if I'm being jabbed here in my back, it means that there's an obstacle in front of me by my right foot and things like that. So, like, the plasticity... I'm going off on one here, right? But the plasticity of our brains and things and the ability for me in the future to, like, have augmented vision and augmented hearing and, what the hell, why not augmented strength, right? I don't know. I think it's, like, really possible. And I think these like, augmented reality systems and what have you are a baby step in that direction. But I wouldn't be surprised if at some point in my lifetime I could have augmented vision and augmented hearing and augmented, well...
strength. Yeah, you're going for super strength there. You want to be a superhero, don't you?
I want to fly.
Yeah, you want to fly. You want VR and AR to just turn you into a superhero. No, but I think what you touched on something that's, I think, really important, which is about the frictionless of a, you know, nature of any new technology. And once it becomes frictionless, once it becomes something like it's a contact lens you put in your eye, and now all of a sudden you can watch TV anytime you want, and a earbud you put in your ear, and now you can hear what you're, you know, what you're watching, and you can import it from your phone to computer, from your TV back to your contacts. Once it becomes that frictionless and that seamless, and also that private, because privacy is one of the key things. People don't want other people to know what they're watching and listening to. Once you have that privacy and seamlessness, you're going to have a mass adoption. If you've got somebody who cracks that, you're going to get people who are like, you know, I'm going to put my earbuds and my contact lenses in. And now I have a total either virtual or augmented reality experience that is totally private to me. No one can tell that I'm doing it at any given time, but I can have the experiences that I want. You have all of those components together and you've got yourself a dynamite product.
There's another business opportunity for us.
I like the contacts. I don't know that I'd be willing to have my brain operated on yet.
Anyway, Nigel apparently is willing. He's ready to go under the knife right now.
Maybe if I were blind, then it'd be an option, but yeah.
Yeah, no, but the thing is, Lauren, right, as soon as somebody else gets that, and I'm sensitive how I say this, right, but you effectively are blind compared to them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Once somebody else, and it gets to a point where there's enough people have something that you don't, you're then at a disadvantage. And if you're not careful, you get left behind.
It's very Black Mirror.
Be warned.
Ooh, oh, yeah. That's actually a good reference. I just watched that one where you have your whole life recorded. And you
right.
Can, it's called a redo. Yeah, you could just do redo. My wife and I talked that a bunch. There's no way I would have that technology in my head. As just you spend your whole life just playing back all the stuff that happened to you in the past.
You're a curmudgeon.
That's right. I'm one of those curmudgeons.
Called somebody a curmudgeon and it's not Mark.
Yeah, I'll be that old person who doesn't have the tech in my eyes, and I'm trying to use Apple Pay at the front of the line at the grocery store. Yeah.
All right, so let's flip this a little bit. Interesting story in business news, and I've got a few questions around this, right? But word is that Microsoft is starting to incentivize people to use its Edge browser, and I just don't get it. So, Rick, you've got some opinions on this, I know that, or some thoughts at least.
Well, you know, I got two things on it. First of all, the good opinion or, you know, response is that it's really a loyalty program. And I actually think it's a good idea. It's not too many clicks off the, pardon the pun, the idea of your little grocery store card that you put on your key ring, okay? But it's a loyalty program for everything you do. I've been looking. I want to get a little bit more information, the terms, the credits, et cetera. You know, I think it's a great idea. I really think it's a great way to seed the broad use of a browser. IT pros, the smart type, probably not going to be fancy
so,
this idea.
Rick, tell me why. Why is it important that somebody uses a particular company's browser?
Well, for one, if you're Microsoft, it's important. Okay, I think it's important from Microsoft's perspective to get the browser usage high. If you think about a couple years ago, they had it and they jacked it up. Now they don't have it. Now they're trying to get it, right? So from Microsoft's perspective, having their market share represented, on the other angle, from the internet's perspective, from the user's perspective, I should really expect that I could walk to any computer, Chrome, Edge, old something with IE, Opera, Firefox, Safari, whatever, and be able to do what I need to do. That's what the internet expects. But everything from Windows 10 to Surface tablets to you know, upgrading and using Edge for those who have it, it's a loyalty program to help seed the market. I think it's a great business strategy, and it's an opt-in. So I actually tried to use Microsoft Rewards for my new fancy Surface purchase, and, you know, I'm thought, well, I'll check it out. So then I literally go to use it, and my Surface blew up and had to reboot itself. So that was a bad omen, so I don't think I should actually do it. It actually just shut down and did a reboot of like some sort of system update of some sort. So I think that's a bad omen. I don't think I should actually do it.
Rick, I just want us to clarify something here right now. Your definition of a shiny new Surface is not a real shiny new Surface.
No, it's not the latest Surface Book or the Surface Pro 4. No, El Ricatron bot used a Surface 3.
Yes. I think that's your problem. But here's an interesting thing, right? I think in order to qualify for the rewards and what have you for using Edge, Microsoft pretty much has to see everything that you're doing. So you've got to have used it for something like 30 hours per month. And it does stuff so that you can't rig the game, or it makes it more difficult to rig the game. It checks whether you're moving the mouse, and it checks whether you're really using it. So there's kind of like a... I don't think I'd care that much about rewards that I'd be willing to let Microsoft. And look, they probably do already snoop that much on me. But for me to know that?
And the mass public and the smart IT user, totally different needs and expectations and concerns around privacy. So I don't expect IT pros to latch onto this. I expect, you know, just the people that use computers, a good chunk of them are going to latch onto this. And I haven't read through the privacy, the terms of the statement pretty deeply, but I'm pretty sure it's very broad and very
okay, privacy.
Privacy.
You've been hanging around Nigel too long.
Hey, I'm going to go ride a zebra later today. Come on, cool.
Hey, do you think it's aimed at poor people? Because I don't think the rewards are massive.
No.
Yes.
Wait, yes. What are you saying about Rick? What are you saying about Rick here?
Yeah, that's right. What, they give out canned food for people for using Edge.
No. So you have you have a little card that you put in your wallet, right? That says Microsoft Rewards.
It's like a government cheese, government browser. Is that what you're getting at? Yes, you know?
Is it tied into food stamps?
Yeah. Maybe. Good grief.
I do not like green eggs and Microsoft Rewards.
Nigel, you have a point there. I think this actually isn't new. Internet Explorer ran it too, at least a couple years ago. I had a coworker who did it and was by no means poor, but very frugal. So maybe you're onto something there.
So not poor people, but tight people, maybe. Right. And that is exactly why Rick tried it out. Mister, I've just bought a shiny new Surface Pro that's actually three generations old.
Actually, it's not even a Pro. It's just a Surface 3.
Oh, hell. There you go.
Okay. You are tight.
Oh, I'm as cheap as they come, guys.
El Cheapatron today.
Indeed.
Right. So, shall we wrap the show up with a bit of a hot or not? So, Lauren, you take us away with hot or not.
All right, guys. So I'm sure you're all familiar with Global Knowledge's annual IT salary report, I should say, which, you know, take it with a grain of salt. I used to read it as when getting started, just to see what's interesting, what's hot out there. But they have a top 15 certifications for basically getting your best salary. I'm not going to read all of them, but, you know, the number one, of course, was AWS Certified Solutions Architect Associate, which actually V Brownbag, the other podcast I'm on, is running the training series on exams for that right now. Some of the other interesting ones, you know, the project management, it's a lot of old school ones, really, like CISSP. I mean, besides AWS, of course, there's a Citrix one in there.
Lauren, did you just say interesting ones, project management, give over?
Oh, it's a I feel like it's an old one.
Don't even go there, Nigel. Don't even go there.
I didn't say old one.
Says the resident PMP. Yes. Don't go there.
So anyway, what do you guys think about this list? I mean, mathematically speaking, I don't think it really has much salt there, but what do you guys think about this list?
I think it's hot, okay, because there's a lot of security, a lot of networking, and it's a lot of cloud on there, and a lot of hacking, which goes back to security, which is a certified ethical hacker one. So, you know, a lot of Cisco. Lauren, you and your family should be happy. But
unfortunately,
I
don't have any of them anymore. But.
right. But I think that it's, you know, it's the network, the security, and the next-gen stuff with cloud is where it's at. I mean, there's one token VMware, one token Citrix virtualization one in there.
Citrix?
Citrix was a little bit of an eye raiser, but hey, you know, data center is where it's at.
Yeah, Citrix is above VMware, actually, which I find a little surprising. Nothing against Citrix, but...
It's more niche, that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah, is there like a lack of people doing it? Because I was kind of... So let me just talk to the AWS certified, whatever it was, right? I was kind of not surprised, unsurprised at the same time. That, like, if you'd seen my face, it would have been like, what is wrong with you? Surprised and not surprised. But the thing is, right, I wasn't surprised because... Obviously, public cloud services are all really hot and a lot of businesses have interest in it right now. But then I'm like, surely it's supposed to simplify stuff. And if you're moving to this new public cloud platform that's supposed to reduce your costs and simplify and what have you, but then the highest paid guy on the sysadmin payroll is your AWS guy, that kind of doesn't measure as right for me. And look, I know the numbers are small in the grand scheme of things, okay, in your wider IT budget. But I was like, I thought this stuff was supposed to be easy. Yet it's like, if you want to get a lot of money, go get that certification. It didn't register for me as being like the way it should be. But I don't know. I guess maybe it's because there are so many companies with an interest in it. And maybe there's like a skills shortage or a gap in the market for skills there. And I guess we always know that when there aren't many people out there that can truly do something, then you can push your prices up.
Is there an OpenStack certification?
There is, and I know that Mirantis got one.
Oh yeah, it's probably like by who you know, whatever Mirantis or Red Hat or whatever. You know,
because that's one that you know kind of see missing newest, hottest, awesomest stuff.
No, but I think this is literally a hot or not list. It's like which ones are hot, which ones are, you know, not, which the ones that aren't on this list.
Well, so let me just finish then. So I would say the AWS one is hot and the security ones are hot. The ITIL one is like that is zero Kelvins for me. Okay. But I think certifications in general are not hot. I don't go for them. They're a big
All right, so yeah, when everyone else talks about this, yeah, let us know if you think certifications are hot in general. But on your point about AWS certification, Nigel, I mean, you think about the people actually getting the certification, it's probably not people just starting off in, you know, this career. I could be totally wrong, but just thinking about it. So they've already kind of had a few years experience, they've already kind of built up their salary, and now they're moving on to the certification, so it makes sense that they make more money in general,
really?
Right?
Does anybody that's got experience bother with certifications? I thought it was the other way around. Like, I've always thought
there are people. Chris Wall.
Oh, yeah, I know. I mean, it's one of those things you validate, you know, some of your skills for it. And it could be something where it's a move internally, and it's, you know, you're creating a new role, and it's part of a certification you get just so you can validate that new role that you're creating. And that's actually why I got my certification was because I actually, you know, wrote out a job description for what I wanted to do, and getting a certification was part of that.
And channel partners, too. I mean, I had to get certifications in order for us to be able to sell things, so it was just a requirement.
I hate them. Just freaking hate them. I've never gotten one. Just can't stand the thought of it.
Hey, Mark, cheeky question. How many times have you tried, though?
Zero.
Good man.
I fail about half of my tests. I'll be honest with you guys.
Oh, yeah.
It's all about lifelong learning, folks. Lifelong learning.
It is, yeah.
Rick, what are your thoughts on this list, and what do you think about certifications in general?
Selectively hot on the list. I'm not interested in the ITIL or PMP ones. Just not my cup of tea. In regards to certifications in general, I think it's a third of what's important. I've always valued formal education, work experience, and certifications to complete the experience of one's abilities. And so it's part of the hot.
Just the whole thought of it just makes me retch and vomit. Yeah.
Tell us how you really feel, Mark.
Don't hold back, Mark. So what do you think, though, Lauren?
I have a different perspective a little bit, I guess, coming out of college with, formal education, like Rick says, Bachelor of Science, but I didn't actually learn anything about this career, right? So I started jumping into getting things like my MCSE and CCNA. And I do believe that helped me get my foot in the door. Now, whether I, at this point in my career, I don't bother anymore. I respect people that do. I don't think it should matter that much, especially if you have the experience. But I think it is helpful for getting in the door and getting at least some hands-on experience, even just in a lab scenario. So if you're 21 years old, maybe think about it. If you're my age or Mark's age, maybe don't worry about it.
Dinosaurs didn't need them.
So if you're 21, go and get a certification. If you're 24, like Lauren, don't bother.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Hey, really? So I've got a quick question for everybody here on certifications, and go around the table again. If you were to get one certification now, what would it be in? And all I'm after is like a technology or a company or anything like that. Lauren, what would you get one in?
Oh, geez. Yeah, I'd probably go for AWS if I was like rethinking my career. I think cloud's where it's at, okay. So I'd probably cool. go yeah. somewhere in the realm of AWS.
Rick?
This point in my career, honestly, I'm transitioning to more the evangelist marketing technical element. I don't really think I'd need, a certification for the next, 5 to 10 years of my career.
You need to invent one for that job role then.
Certified technical evangelist.
There you go. Yeah. Certified TEV. Eugene, what would you go for if you were going to get cert? Or maybe you have?
Yeah. No, I would actually go for the OpenStack one that's not on this list. I've always been fascinated with OpenStack and the whole community. But I'd probably, I'd probably learn Python first and then go for an OpenStack certification.
Yeah. Mark, I know you wouldn't, right? But if you would, what would you?
Sex therapist or brewmaster?
Hey, I want to change my answer to what Mark just said.
You mean you're not already a certified brewmaster?
Your poor patients.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Let me solve all of your problems with beer that I've brewed.
Yes. Yeah, is there a way to combine the two?
Exactly.
Beer's always good for the libido.
There you go.
Hey, yes, very good. So actually, following on from last week's podcast, I'm going to give the microphone to Rick as we just wind out with a little something different.
Well, it's a big old knot, and we had a few corrections with a few points from the podcast last week, notably the fact that we had said that there's no AWS region in Australia.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, we kind of had all the fail going on, and appreciate the listeners correcting us on that. And I think they had said that since 2012, AWS had had a region in Australia, in particular Sydney. I know they've had they've had Singapore and then north up in Japan and all that. And then the other thing Mr. Troyer pointed out is that Silicon Graphics went bankrupt in 2009. Rackable bought it, took the name, not really the same company, and I think that's all that we messed up last week.
You guys, just a quick question since I wasn't here last week.
Right, Lauren. Good one.
I'll point that out first. But also, were you guys using Bing Maps to figure out where Amazon was located?
Oh.
Oh. We were trying to find Australia.
Well, yeah, there's no data center yet in the middle of the water, of course. It was
yeah.
And I believe you meant Africa.
I just Bing searched that. It's in the Pacific Ocean. That's where.
Did you get a Starbucks gift card for that Bing search?
You know, when a lot of these discussions go on during the show, like sometimes we will look them up. Did anybody try to look this up last week and use Bing and then find out that Amazon was not in Australia?
Why don't we just blame Bing?
Well, Mark, since I wasn't here last week either, I wasn't able to do that.
I guess that leaves Frick, me, and Gabriel.
It's always Gabe's fault. He's not here, so, you know, he brought it up.
I think Gabriel said it. I think he did bring it up, and I think he does use Edge.
He meant to say Africa. There actually is no AWS in Africa right now.
Well, he might have been thinking of Azure, because there's no Azure in Australia. That's just
maybe.
And, nor Africa, just for the record.
Did you look that up?
I'm looking now, because I'm feeling guilty.
I learned it on the V. Brownbag podcast, so.
See how educational podcasts can be?
Mm-hmm. Yes. There's always being
dangerous.
Yeah, we actually have an instance in Australia. Here, our company.
Looks like Azure does.
I probably would have chimed in there.
Azure is too. They've got Melbourne. Oh, that's not off the coast of Japan, and then they've got Sydney. Like, is what it looks like. Oh.